I thanked him and asked in a whisper, "May I also take the prizes for the Cerullo family so I can deliver them?" The teacher gave me the prize books for all the Cerullos. As we went out, while Carmela resentfully joined Giliola, who was happily chatting with Alfonso and Gino, Pasquale said to me, in dialect, things that made me laugh even more, about Reno losing his eyesight over his books, Fernando the shoemaker who didn't sleep at night because he was reading, Signora Nunzia, who read standing up next to the stove while she was cooking pasta with potatoes, in one hand a novel and in the other the spoon. He had been in elementary school with Reno, in the same class, at the same desk, he said, tears of amusement in his eyes. And both of them, he and his friend, even though they took turns helping each other, after 6 or 7 years of school, including repeats, managed to read at most tobacconist, grocery, post office. Then he asked me what the prize for his former schoolmate was. Bruges la Mort. Are there ghosts? I don't know. May I come along when you give it to him? Rather, may I give it to him with my own hands? We burst out laughing again. Yes. They've given Renuccio a prize. Crazy. It's Lena who reads everything. Good Lord, that girl is clever. The attentions of Pasquale Peluso consoled me greatly. I liked that he made me laugh. Maybe I'm not so ugly, I thought. Maybe I can't see myself. At that moment, I heard someone calling me. It was Maestra Oliviero. I went over, and she looked at me, as always evaluating, and said, as if confirming the legitimacy of a more generous judgment about my looks, "How pretty you are. How big you've gotten." "It's not true, Maestra." "It's true. You're a star. Healthy, nice, and plump. And also clever. I heard that you were the top student in the school." "Yes. Now what will you do?"
"I'll go to work." She darkened.
"Don't even mention it. You have to go on studying."
I looked at her in surprise. What was there left to study? I didn't know anything about the order of schools. I didn't have a clear idea what there was after the middle school diploma. Words like high school, university, were for me without substance. Like many of the words I came across in novels. "I can't. My parents won't let me."
"What did the literature teacher give you in Latin?"
9.
"Sure?"
"Yes."
"Then I'll talk to your parents."
I started to leave, a little scared, I have to admit.
If Maestra Oliviero really went to my father and mother to tell them to let me continue in school, it would again unleash quarrels that I didn't want to face. I preferred things as they were, help my mother, work in the stationery store, accept the ugliness and the pimples, be healthy, nice, and plump, as Maestra Oliviero said, and toil in poverty. Hadn't Leila been doing it for at least 3 years already, apart from her crazy dreams as the sister and daughter of shoemakers?
"Thank you, Maestra," I said. "Goodbye."
But Oliviero held me by one arm. "Don't waste time with him," she said, indicating Pasquale, who was waiting for me. "He's a construction worker. He'll never go farther than that. And then he comes from a bad family. His father is a communist and murdered Don Achille. I absolutely don't want to see you with him. He's surely a communist like his father."
I nodded in assent and went off without saying goodbye to Pasquale, who seemed bewildered. Then, with pleasure, I heard him following me, a dozen steps behind. He wasn't good-looking, but I wasn't pretty anymore either. He had curly black hair, He was dark-skinned and sunburned. He had a wide mouth and was the son of a murderer. Maybe even a communist. I turned the word over and over in my head. Communist. A word that was meaningless to me, but which the teacher had immediately branded with negativity. Communist. 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 It captivated me. Communist and son of a murderer. Meanwhile, around the corner, Pasquale caught up with me. We walked together until we were a few steps from my house and, laughing again, made a date for the next day, when we would go to the shoemaker's shop to give the books to Leela and Reno. Before we parted, Pasquale also said that the following Sunday, he, his sister, and anyone who wanted, were going to Giliola's house to learn to dance. He asked if I wanted to go, maybe with Leela. I was astonished. I already knew that my mother would never let me. But still, I said, "All right, I'll think about it." Then he held out his hand, and I, who was not used to such gestures, hesitated, just brushed his, which was hard and rough, and withdrew mine. "Are you always going to be a construction worker?" I asked, even though I already knew that he was. "Yes." "And you're a communist?" He looked at me perplexed. "Yes." "And you go see your father at Poggio Reale?" He turned serious. "When I can." "Bye." "Bye." 10. Maestra Oliviero, that same afternoon, presented herself at my house without warning, throwing my father into utter despair and embittering my mother. She made them both swear that they would enroll me in the nearest classical high school. She offered to find me the books I would need herself. She reported to my father, but looking at me severely, that she had seen me alone with Pasquale Peluso, company that was completely unsuitable for me, who embodied such high hopes. My parents didn't dare contradict her. They swore solemnly that they would send me to the first year of high school, and my father said, in a menacing tone, "Lenu, don't you dare ever speak to Pasquale Peluso again." Before she left, the teacher asked me about Leela, still in the presence of my parents. I answered that she was helping her father and her brother. She kept the accounts and the shop in order. She made a grimace of contempt. She asked me, "Does she know you got a 9 in Latin?" I nodded yes. "Tell her that now you're going to study Greek, too." "Tell her." She took leave of my parents with an air of pride. "This girl," she exclaimed, "will bring us great satisfaction." That evening, while my mother, furious, was saying that now there was no choice but to send me to the school for rich people, otherwise Oliviero would wear her out by tormenting her and would even fail little Elisa in reprisal, while my father, as if this were the main problem, threatened to break both my legs if he heard that I had been alone with Pasquale Peluso, we heard a loud cry that silenced us. It was Ada, Melina's daughter, crying for help. We ran to the window. There was a great commotion in the courtyard. It seemed that Melina, who after the Saratori's moved had generally behaved herself, a little melancholy, yes, a little absent-minded, but in essence her eccentricities had become infrequent and harmless, like singing loudly while she washed the stairs of the buildings, or dumping buckets of dirty water into the street without paying attention to passers-by, was having a new crisis of madness, a sort of crazy outburst of joy. She was laughing, jumping on the bed and pulling up her skirt, displaying her fleshless thighs and her underpants to her frightened children. This my mother found out, by questioning from her window the other women looking out of their windows. I saw that Nunzia Cerullo and Lila were hurrying to see what was happening, and I tried to slip out the door to join them, but my mother stopped me. She smoothed her hair and, with her limping gait, went herself to see what was going on. When she returned, she was indignant. Someone had delivered a book to Melina. A book, yes, a book. To her, who had at most 2 years of elementary school and had never read a book in her life. The book bore on the cover the name of Donato Saratore. Inside, on the first page, it had an inscription in pen to Melina, and also marked, with red ink, were the poems he had written for her. My father, hearing that strange news, insulted the railway worker poet obscenely. My mother said someone should undertake to bash the disgusting head of that disgusting man. All night, we heard Melina singing with happiness. We heard the voices of her children, especially Antonio and Ada, trying to calm her, but failing. I, however, was overcome with amazement. On a single day, I had attracted the attention of a young man like Pasquale. A new school had opened up before me, and I had discovered that a person who until some time earlier had lived in the neighborhood, in the building across from ours, had published a book. This last fact proved that Lila had been right to think that such a thing could ever happen to us. Of course, she had given it up now. But perhaps I, by going to that difficult school called high school, fortified by the love of Pasquale, could write one myself, as Saratore had done. Who knows? If everything worked out for the best, I would become rich before Lila, with her shoe designs and her shoe factory. 11. The next day, I went secretly to meet Pasquale Peluso. He arrived out of breath and sweaty in his work clothes, spotted all over with splotches of white plaster. On the way, I told him the story of Donato and Melina. I told him that in these latest events was the proof that Melina wasn't mad, that Donato really had been in love with her and still loved her. But as I spoke, even as Pasquale agreed with me, revealing a sensitivity about things to do with love, I realized that, of these developments, what continued to excite me more than anything else was the fact that Donato Saratore had published a book. That employee of the State Railroad had become the author of a volume that Maestro Ferraro might very well put in a library and lend. Therefore, I said to Pasquale, we had all known not an ordinary man, put upon by the nagging of his wife Lydia, but a poet. Therefore, right before our eyes, a tragic love had been born, inspired by a person we knew very well. That is to say, Melina. I was very excited. My heart was pounding. But I realized that here Pasquale couldn't follow me. He said yes, only so as not to contradict me. And in fact, after a while he became evasive and began to ask me questions about Lila, how she had been at school, what I thought of her, if we were close friends. I answered willingly. It was the first time anyone had asked me about our friendship, and I talked about it enthusiastically the whole way. Also, for the first time, I felt how, having to search for words on a subject where I didn't have words ready, I tended to reduce the relationship between Lila and me to extreme declarations that were all exaggeratedly positive. When we got to the shoemaker's shop, we were still talking about it. Fernando had gone home for the afternoon rest, but Lila and Reno stood next to each other scowling, bent over something that they looked at with hostility. And as soon as they saw us outside the glass door, they put it away. I handed Maestro Ferraro's gifts to Lila while Pasquale teased Reno, opening the prize under his nose and saying, "After you've read the story of this Bruges the Dead, tell me if you liked it, and maybe I'll read it too." They laughed a lot, and every so often whispered to each other remarks about Bruges, which were surely obscene. But I noticed that Pasquale, although he was joking with Reno, looked furtively at Leela. Why was he looking at her like that? What was he looking for? What did he see there? They were long, intense looks that she didn't seem to be aware of. Well, it seemed to me, Reno was even more aware of them than I was, and he soon drew Pasquale out into the street as if to keep us from hearing what was so funny about Bruges, but in reality, irritated by the way his friend was looking at his sister. I went with Leela to the back of the shop, trying to perceive in her what had attracted Pasquale's attention. She seemed to me the same slender girl, skin and bone, pale, except perhaps for the larger shape of her eyes and a slight curve in her chest. She arranged the books with other books she had, amid the old shoes and some notebooks with battered covers. I mentioned Melina's madness, but above all I tried to communicate my excitement at the fact that we could say we knew someone who had just published a book, Donato Sartore. I murmured in Italian, "Think, his son Nino was in school with us. Think, the whole Sartore family might become rich." She gave a skeptical half-smile. "With this?" she said. She held out her hand and showed me Sartore's book. Antonio, Melina's oldest son, had given it to her to get it out of the sight and hands of his mother. I held it. I examined the slim volume. It was called Attempts at Serenity. The cover was red, with a drawing of the sun shining on a mountaintop. It was exciting to read, right above the title, Donato Sartore. I opened it, read aloud the dedication in pen. "To Melina, who nurtured my poetry, Donato. Naples, 12 June, 1958. I was moved. I felt a shiver at the back of my neck, at the roots of my hair. I said, "Nina will have a better car than the Solaras." But Leela had one of her intense looks, and I saw that she was focused on the book I had in my hand. "If it happens, we'll know about it," she muttered. "For now, those poems have done only damage." "Why?" "Sartore didn't have the courage to go in person to Melina, and in place he sent her the book." "Isn't it a fine thing?" "Who knows? Now Melina expects him, and if Sartore doesn't come, she'll suffer more than she's suffered till now." What wonderful conversations. I looked at her white, smooth skin, not a blemish. I looked at her lips, the delicate shape of her ears. Yes, I thought, maybe she's changing. And not only physically, but in the way she expresses herself. It seemed to me, articulated in words of today, that not only did she know how to put things well, but she was developing a gift that I was already familiar with. More effectively than she had as a child, she took the facts and, in a natural way, charged them with tension. She intensified reality as she reduced it to words. She injected it with energy. But I also realized, with pleasure, that as soon as she began to do this, I felt able to do the same. And I tried, and it came easily. This, I thought contentedly, distinguishes me from Carmela and all the others. I get excited with her, here, at the very moment when she's speaking to me. What beautiful, strong hands she has. What graceful gestures came to her. What looks. But while Leela talked about love, while I talked about it, the pleasure was spoiled by an ugly thought. I suddenly realized that I had been mistaken. Pasquale, the construction worker, the communist, the son of the murderer, had wanted to go there with me not for me, but for her. To have the chance to see her. 12. The thought took my breath away for a moment. When the two young men returned, interrupting our conversation, Pasquale confessed, laughing, that he had left the work site without saying anything to the boss, so he had to go back right away. I noticed that he looked at Leela again for a long time, intensely, almost against his will, perhaps to signal to her, "I'm running the risk of losing my job just for you." Addressing Reno, he said, "Sunday we're all going dancing at Giliola's. Even Lenucci's coming. Will you two come?" "Sunday is a long way off. We'll think about it later," Reno answered. Pasquale gave a last look at Leela, who paid no attention to him. Then he slipped away, without asking if I wanted to go with him. I felt an irritation that made me nervous. I began touching the most inflamed areas of my cheeks with my fingers. Then I realized it and forced myself not to. While Reno took out from under the bench the things he had been working on before we arrived and was studying them in bewilderment, I started talking again to Leela about books, about love affairs. We inflated excessively Saratore, Melina's love madness, the role of the book. What would happen? What reactions would be unleashed, not by the reading of the poems, but by the object itself? The fact that its cover, the title, the name and surname, had again stirred that woman's heart. We talked so fervently that Reno suddenly lost patience and shouted at us, "Will you stop it? Leela, let's get to work. Otherwise Papa will return and we won't be able to do anything." We stopped. I glanced at what they were doing. A wooden form besieged by a tangle of soles, strips of skin, pieces of thick leather, amid knives and awls and various other tools. Leela told me that she and Reno were trying to make a man's traveling shoe. And her brother, right afterward, made me swear on my sister Elisa that I would never say a word about it to anyone. They were working in secret from Fernando. Reno had got the skins and the leather from a friend who worked at a tannery at Ponte di Casanova. They would devote 5 minutes here, 10 tomorrow, to making the shoe, because there was no way to persuade their father to help them. In fact, when they had brought up the subject, Fernando had sent Leela home, shouting that he didn't want to see her in the shop anymore. And meanwhile, he had threatened to kill Reno, who at the age of 19 was lacking in respect and had got it in his head to be better than his father. I pretended to be interested in their secret undertaking, but in fact, I was very sorry about it. Although the two siblings had involved me by choosing me as their confidant, it was still an experience that I could enter only as witness. On that path, Leela would do great things by herself. I was excluded. But above all, how, after our intense conversations about love and poetry, could she walk me to the door, as she was doing, far more absorbed in the atmosphere of excitement around a shoe? We had talked with such pleasure about Saratore and Melina. I couldn't believe that, though she pointed out to me that heap of leathers and skins and tools, she did not still feel, as I did, the anxiety about a woman who was suffering for love. What did I care about shoes? I still had, in my mind's eye, the most secret stages of that affair of violated trust, passion, poetry that became a book. And it was as if she and I had read a novel together. As if we had seen, there in the back of the shop and not in the parish hall on Sunday, a dramatic film. I felt grieved at the waste, because I was compelled to go away, because she preferred the adventure of shoes to our conversation, because she knew how to be autonomous, whereas I needed her, because she had her things that I couldn't be part of. Because Pasquale, who was a grown-up, not a boy, certainly would seek other occasions to gaze at her and plead with her and try to persuade her to secretly be his girlfriend and be kissed, touched, as it was said people did when they became boyfriend and girlfriend. Because, in short, she would feel that I was less and less necessary. Therefore, as if to chase away the feeling of revulsion these thoughts inspired, as if to emphasize my value and my indispensability, I told her in a rush that I was going to the high school. I told her at the doorway of the shop when I was already in the street. I told her that Maestra Oliviero had insisted to my parents, promising to get me used books for nothing, herself. I did it because I wanted her to realize that I was special, and that even if she became rich making shoes with Reno, she couldn't do without me, as I couldn't do without her. She looked at me perplexed. "What is high school?" she asked. "An important school that comes after middle school. And what are you going to do there?"
"Study."
"What?" "Latin." "That's all?"
"And Greek."
"Greek?"
"Yes."
She had the expression of someone at a loss, finding nothing to say. Finally, she murmured, irrelevantly, "Last week I got my period." And although Reno hadn't called her, she went back inside. 13. So now she was bleeding, too. The secret movements of the body, which had reached me first, had arrived like the tremor of an earthquake in her as well, and would change her. She was already changing. Pasquale, I thought, had realized it before me. He and probably other boys. The fact that I was going to high school quickly lost its aura. For days, all I could think of was the unknowability of the changes that would hit Leela. Would she become pretty like Pinuccia Caracci, or Giliola, or Carmela? Would she turn ugly like me? I went home and examined myself in the mirror. What was I like, really? What would she, sooner or later, be like? I began to take more care with myself. One Sunday afternoon, on the occasion of the usual walk from the Stradone to the gardens, I put on my best dress, which was blue, with a square neckline, and also my mother's silver bracelet. When I met Leela, I felt a secret pleasure in seeing her as she was every day, in a worn, faded dress, her black hair untidy. There was nothing to differentiate her from the usual Leela, a restless, skinny girl. Only she seemed taller. She had grown. From a small girl, almost as tall as me, maybe half an inch less. But what was that change? I had a large bosom, a womanly figure. We reached the gardens. We turned and went back, then walked along the street again to the gardens. It was early. There wasn't yet the Sunday commotion, the sellers of roasted hazelnuts and almonds and lupini. Leela was again asking me tentatively about the high school. I told her what I knew, exaggerating as much as possible. I wanted her to be curious, to want at least a little to share my adventure from the outside, to feel she was losing something of me, as I always feared losing much of her. I was on the street side, she on the inside. I was talking, she was listening attentively. The Solara's 1100 pulled up beside us. Michele was driving, Next to him was Marcello, who began to joke with us. With both of us, not just me. He would sing softly, in dialect, phrases like, "What lovely young ladies. Aren't you tired of going back and forth? Look how big Naples is. The most beautiful city in the world. As beautiful as you. Get in. Half an hour, and we'll bring you back here." I shouldn't have, but I did. Instead of going straight ahead as if neither he, nor the car, nor his brother existed, instead of continuing to talk to Leela and ignoring them, I turned, and out of a need to feel attractive and lucky and on the verge of going to the rich people's school, where I would likely find boys with cars much nicer than the Solaras, said, in Italian, "Thank you, but we can't." Marcello reached out a hand. I saw that it was broad and short, although he was a tall, well-made young man. The five fingers passed through the window and grabbed me by the wrist, while his voice said, "Mike, slow down. You see that nice bracelet the porter's daughter is wearing?" The car stopped. Marcello's fingers around my wrist made my skin turn cold, and I pulled my arm away in disgust. The bracelet broke, falling between the sidewalk and the car. "Oh my God, look what you've made me do," I exclaimed, thinking of my mother.
"Calm down," he said,
and opening the door, got out of the car.
"I'll fix it for you."
He was smiling, friendly. He tried again to take my wrist as if to establish a familiarity that would soothe me. It was an instant. Leela, half the size of him, pushed him against the car and whipped the shoemaker's knife under his throat. She said calmly, in dialect, "Touch her again, and I'll show you what happens." Marcello, incredulous, froze. Michele immediately got out of the car and said in a reassuring tone,
"Don't worry, Marce. This whore doesn't have the guts."
"Come here," Leela said. "Come here, and you'll find out if I have the guts." Michele came around the car, and I began to cry. From where I was, I could see that the point of the knife had already cut Marcello's skin, a scratch from which came a tiny thread of blood. The scene is clear in my mind. It was still very hot. There were few passers-by. Leela was on Marcello as if she had seen a nasty insect on his face and wanted to chase it away. In my mind, there remains the absolute certainty I had then. She wouldn't have hesitated to cut his throat. Michele also realized it.
"Okay, good for you," he said.
And with the same composure, as if he were amused, he got back in the car.
"Get in, Marce. Apologize to the ladies, and let's go."
Leela slowly removed the point of the blade from Marcello's throat. He gave her a timid smile. His gaze was disoriented.
"Just a minute," he said.
He knelt on the sidewalk in front of me, as if he wanted to apologize by subjecting himself to the highest form of humiliation. He felt around under the car, recovered the bracelet, examined it, and repaired it by squeezing with his nails the silver link that had come apart. He gave it to me, not looking at me, but at Leela. It was to her that he said,
"Sorry."
Then he got in the car and they drove off. "I was crying because of the bracelet, not because I was scared," I said. 14. The boundaries of the neighborhood faded in the course of that summer. One morning, my father took me with him. Since I was enrolling in high school, he wanted me to know what public transportation I would have to take, and what route when I went in October to the new school. It was a beautiful, very clear, windy day. I felt loved, coddled. To my affection for him was added a crescendo of admiration.
He knew the enormous expanse of the city intimately. He knew where to get the metro, or a tram, or a bus. Outside, he behaved with a sociability, a relaxed courtesy, that at home he almost never had. He was friendly toward everyone, on the metro, and the buses, in the offices, and he always managed to let his interlocutor know that he worked for the city, and that, if he liked, he could speed up practical matters, open doors. We spent the entire day together, the only one in our lives. I don't remember any others. He dedicated himself to me, as if he wanted to communicate in a few hours everything useful he had learned in the course of his existence. He showed me Piazza Garibaldi and the station that was being built. According to him, it was so modern that the Japanese were coming from Japan to study it, in particular the columns, and build an identical one in their country. But he confessed that he liked the old station better. He was more attached to it. Ah, well. Naples, he said, had always been like that. It's cut down, it's broken up, and then it's rebuilt. And the money flows and creates work. He took me along Corso Garibaldi to the building that would be my school. He dealt in the office with extreme good humor. He had the gift of congeniality, a gift that in the neighborhood and at home he kept hidden. He boasted of my extraordinary report card to a janitor whose wedding witness, he discovered on the spot, he knew well. I heard him repeating often, "Everything in order?" or "Everything that can be done is being done." He showed me Piazza Carlo Terza, the Albergo dei Poveri, the Botanical Garden, Via Foria, the museum. He took me on Via Constantinopoli, to Portalba, to Piazza Dante, to Via Toledo. I was overwhelmed by the names, the noise of the traffic, the voices, the colors, the festive atmosphere, the effort of keeping everything in mind so that I could talk about it later with Leela, the ease with which he chatted with the pizza maker from whom he bought me a pizza melting with ricotta, the fruit seller from whom he bought me a yellow peach. Was it possible that only our neighborhood was filled with conflicts and violence, while the rest of the city was radiant? Benevolent? He took me to see the place where he worked, in Piazza Municipio. There, too, he said, everything had changed. The trees had been cut down. Everything was broken up. Now, see all the space? The only old thing left is the Maschio Angioino. But it's beautiful, little one. There are two real males in Naples. Your father and that fellow there. We went to the city hall. He greeted this person and that. Everyone knew him. With some he was friendly and introduced me, repeating yet again that in school I had gotten 9 in Italian and 9 in Latin. With others he was almost mute. Only, indeed, yes, you command and I obey. Finally, he said that he would show me Vesuvius from close up. And the sea. It was an unforgettable moment. We went toward Via Caracciolo as the wind grew stronger, the sun brighter. Vesuvius was a delicate pastel-colored shape, at whose base the whitish stones of the city were piled up, with the earth-colored slice of the Castel dell'Ovo and the sea. But what a sea! It was very rough and loud. The wind took your breath away, pasted your clothes to your body, and blew the hair off your forehead. We stayed on the other side of the street in a small crowd, watching the spectacle. The waves rolled in like blue metal tubes carrying an egg white of foam on their peaks, then broke in a thousand glittering splinters and came up to the street with an oh of wonder and fear from those watching. What a pity that Leela wasn't there. I felt dazed by the powerful gusts, by the noise. I had the impression that, Although I was absorbing much of that sight, many things, too many, were scattering around me without letting me grasp them. My father held tight to my hand as if he were afraid that I would slip away. In fact, I had the wish to leave him, run, move, cross the street, be struck by the brilliant scales of the sea. At that tremendous moment, full of light and sound, I pretended I was alone in the newness of the city, new myself with all life ahead, exposed to the mutable fury of things, but surely triumphant. I and Leela, we too, with that capacity that together, only together, we had to seize the mass of colors, sounds, things, and people, and express it, and give it power. I returned to the neighborhood as if I had gone to a distant land. Here again the known streets. Here again the grocery of Stefano and his sister Pinuccia, Enzo, who sold fruit, the Solara's 1100 parked in front of the bar. Now I would have paid any amount for it to be eliminated from the face of the earth. Luckily, my mother had never found out about the episode of the bracelet. Luckily, no one had reported to Reno what had happened. I told Leela about the streets, their names, the noise, the extraordinary light. But immediately I felt uncomfortable. If she had been telling the story of that day, I would have joined in with an indispensable counter-melody, and, even if I hadn't been present, I would have felt alive and active. I would have asked questions, raised issues. I would have tried to show her that we had to take that same journey together, necessarily, because I would be enriched by it. I would have been a much better companion than her father. She instead listened to me without curiosity, and at first I thought it was malicious to diminish the force of my enthusiasm. But I had to persuade myself it wasn't so. She simply had her own train of thought that was fed on concrete things, a book, a fountain. With her ears, certainly, she listened to me. But with her eyes, with her mind, she was solidly anchored to the street, to the few plants in the gardens, to Giliola, who was walking with Alfonso and Carmela, to Pasquale, who waved at her from the scaffolding of the building site, to Melina, who spoke out loud of Donato Salvatore while Ada tried to drag her into the house, to Stefano, the son of Don Achille, who had just bought a giardinetta and had his mother beside him, and in the back seat his sister Pinuccia, to Marcello and Michele Solara, who passed in their 1100, with Michele pretending not to see us, while Marcello gave us a friendly glance, and above all, to the secret work, kept hidden from her father that she applied herself to, advancing the project of the shoes. My story, for her, was at that moment only a collection of useless signals from useless spaces. She would be concerned with those spaces only if she had the opportunity to go there. And in fact, after all my talk, she said only, "I have to tell Reno that Sunday we should accept Pasquale Peluso's invitation." There I was, telling her about the center of Naples, and she placed at the center Giliola's house, in one of the apartment buildings of the neighborhood, where Pasquale wanted to take her dancing. I was sorry. To Peluso's invitations we had always said yes, and yet we had never gone. I, to avoid arguments with my parents, she, because Reno was against it. We often saw him, on holidays, all cleaned up, waiting for his friends, old and young. He was a generous soul. He didn't make distinctions of age. He brought along anyone. He would wait in front of the gas station, and one or two at a time, Enzo and Giliola and Carmelo, who now called herself Carmen, and sometimes Reno himself if he had nothing else to do, and Antonio, who had the weight of his mother, Melina, and, if Melina was calm, also his sister, Ada, whom the Salados had dragged into their car and driven who knows where for an hour. When the day was fine, they went to the sea, returning red-faced from the sun. Or, more often, they all met at Giliola's, whose parents were more tolerant than ours. And there, those who knew how to dance, danced, and those who didn't, learned. Lila began to go to these little parties, and to take me. She had developed, I don't know how, an interest in dancing. Both Pasquale and Reno turned out to be surprisingly good dancers, and we learned from them the tango, the waltz, the polka, the mazurka. Reno, it should be said, as a teacher, got annoyed immediately, especially with his sister, while Pasquale was very patient. At first, he would have us dance standing on his feet so that we learned the steps. Then, when we became more skilled, we went whirling through the house. I discovered that I liked to dance. I would have danced forever. Lila instead wore the expression of someone who wants to understand how it's done, and whose pleasure seems to consist entirely in learning, since often she stayed seated, watching us, studying us, and applauding the couples who were most in sync. Once, at her house, she showed me a book that she had taken from the library. It was all about the dances, and every movement was explained with black and white drawings of a man and woman dancing. She was very cheerful in that period, with an exuberance surprising in her. Abruptly, she grabbed me around the waist and, playing the man, made me dance the tango as she sang the music. Reno looked in and saw us, and burst into laughter. He wanted to dance too, first with me, then with his sister, though without music. While we danced, he told me that Lila had such a mania for perfection that she was obliged to practice continuously, even if they didn't have a gramophone. But as soon as he said the word, gramophone, 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 Lila shouted at me from a corner of the room, narrowing her eyes. You know what kind of word it is? No. Greek. I looked at her uncertainly. Reno, meanwhile, let me go and went to dance with his sister, who gave a soft cry.